Hello, fellow Earth folks. I'm Annie Gigg, GYG, here on CFRU 93.3 FM and CFRU.ca, available wherever you are in the world. Warm welcome to Better Me, Better World, the show for growth-minded changemakers, difference makers, and happiness makers. In this episode, I'm indulging in a rant regarding a matter I've thought about for several years now. It concerns the health of our natural environment, and I call it the evil eye. Britannica.com describes evil eye as a glance believed to have the ability to cause injury or death to those on whom it falls. There is evidence that belief in the evil eye has been around since prehistory, as amulets to protect our ancestors against it are known to have been made about 5,000 years ago. I believe we humans have been giving Mother Nature the evil eye for much, much longer than we've been making amulets to protect ourselves from it. It's just that back in the really old days, like 150,000 years or so ago, the curse of the evil eye that humans were casting on Mother Nature at the time was much weaker, way less injurious, definitely not fatal, as is the curse today. Around about 150,000 years ago, our earliest ancestors left a set of shell beads in a cave in what is now described as the Western Morocco Desert. Archaeologists say it's the world's oldest jewelry. It's been estimated that back then there may have been about 100,000 to 300,000 Homo sapiens calling Earth home, roughly 0.0025% of the current world population. So, even though humans were already using the Earth's resources to make pretty things, because there were so few of us, relatively speaking, and our manufacturing technology was somewhat primitive, our impact on the natural environment was negligible. Nonetheless, this discovery of prehistoric jewelry proves we humans have liked pretty things for a long, long time, and for eons we've been using the Earth's resources to craft them. It's like our eyes have an insatiable appetite, wanting to feast on beauty always, and we'll go to any lengths, even killing our planet, I contend, to make pretty things to satisfy our voracious eyes and at the same time enhance our social status, because the two go hand in hand. Hence, me playing with the term evil eye. Our evil, greedy eyes, wanting ever more pretty stuff, are cursing Mother Nature to the point of serious injury, or if left unchecked, even death. What am I being so dramatic about? Well, let's think about it. Let's consider some of the ways we humans are bent on creating beauty and the environmental cost of our beauty addiction. And let's start with jewelry, since our ancestors started beautifying their world with jewelry a long time ago. But before I delve in, I want to point out that aesthetic appeal has evolved out of functionality in every aspect of beauty I'm considering here. For example, in the very beginning, the earliest jewelry wearers often wore it to mark their status and/or ward off evil. But I'll talk more about this evolution from functionality to aesthetics in a bit. Sustainability-chic.com has an excellent article called "How Sustainable and Ethical is Conventional Jewelry?" Here are a few key points. In 2023, worldwide, consumers spent about $348 billion in jewelry. This consumption has disastrous consequences on the environment and people working in the supply chain. Most precious metals and gemstones are mined in some of the poorest countries in the world, where there are barely any environmental and social regulations. On average, to produce one polished carat of mined diamond, 250 tons of earth are displaced, 160 kilograms of greenhouse gases are created, 20 tons of waste are generated, all for a one carat diamond. Mining releases many toxic elements into the air and hazardous chemicals into land and water. Both costume and fine jewelry are incredibly unsustainable and unethical to produce, considering that human exploitation, pollution, and environmental destruction are common. No doubt, beautiful jewels and gemstones are pleasing to the eye. Even crows think so. But how deadly of a curse are we prepared to continue putting on Mother Earth to gaze at the sparkle of our bling? And if you think we spend a lot on jewelry, get this. Statista.com says the value of the global cosmetics market is projected to be about $758.4 billion U.S. dollars in 2025. We humans like to pay a pretty penny to pretty up our body, but what is the earthly cost of our beautification? The article called Beauty at What Cost? The Environmental Impact of Cosmetic Ingredients and Materials by Lucas Gutierrez on sustainableearth.org says, the impact of the beauty industry and cosmetic ingredients on the planet is immense and cannot be ignored. From excessive packaging waste to the tune of 120 billion units each year, to the use of natural resources like palm and soy, the beauty industry has significant sustainability implications. End of quote. As it's generally now known, the non-degradable microplastics, often containing toxic chemicals found in cosmetics and cosmetic packaging waste, is making its way into landfills and oceans, wreaking havoc on the planet and getting into the system of many living things, including humans. Just like with jewelry, humans' use of cosmetics is nothing new. 6,000 years ago, people in ancient Egypt were into it. I'm sure you can picture the images of Egyptian men and women from about 4,000 BCE with their striking eyeliner. Thankfully, it appears for the first time in six millennia, there is a downward trend beginning in the industry with a move towards more natural beauty. Let's hope this trend persists and accelerates for the sake of nature's beauty. So I've spoken about jewelry and cosmetics that we humans like to use to beautify our looks and become aesthetically appealing to others, but the amount we collectively invest in these products is modest compared to what we humans spend on our clothing. And unlike cosmetics, our investment in our garments is sadly not decreasing. According to Oberlo.com, the latest global apparel industry statistics show that revenue from the apparel market is expected to hit $1.79 trillion in 2024, a 3.47% year-over-year increase from 2023's $1.73 trillion. This marks significant growth over the past 6 years. End of quote. Fashion is not a big business. It's a massively huge business, and the environmental cost of us dressing to the T is likewise massively huge. So many online sources, from the United Nations to universities to governments to health institutions to environmental sites, have reams of information, data, and statistics on the curse we've put on Mother Nature because of our species wanting to satisfy the beauty cravings of our evil eye. The Geneva Environment Network concisely sums up the environmental footprint of fast fashion. I quote, the equivalent of one garbage truck full of clothes is burned or dumped in a landfill every second. Approximately 60% of all materials used by the fashion industry are made from plastic. 500,000 tons of microfibers are released into the ocean each year from washing clothes, the equivalent of 50 billion plastic bottles. The fashion industry is responsible for 8 to 10% of humanity's carbon emissions, more than all international flights and maritime shipping combined. If the fashion sector continues on its current trajectory, that share of the carbon budget could jump to 26% by 2050. Some 93 billion cubic meters of water, enough to meet the needs of 5 million people, is used by the fashion industry annually, contributing significantly to water scarcity in some regions. Around 20% of industrial wastewater pollution worldwide originates from the fashion industry. So there's lots and lots of talk about the environmental horrors of the fashion industry. But does our nicely dressed species have the wherewithal to take serious action to address our crimes against nature, and by virtue of our dependency on nature, crimes against humanity? Wikipedia says, slow fashion, is a movement that seeks to oppose fast fashion, focusing on the production and sale of sustainable clothing created with eco-friendly materials. The movement encourages purchasing clothing from local sources as opposed to large brands, as these locally made pieces are often of a higher quality and will last longer than factory-made clothing and will reduce pollution caused by the disposal of clothes. The slow fashion movement also challenges the ethical issues of fast fashion, such as the underpaying and overworking of factory workers who often come from low-income countries. To this, I add, I certainly understand that clothing affordability is a significant factor in contributing to the robustness of the fast fashion industry, which mass produces cheaper, but sadly, disposable clothing. Surely, however, where there is a will, there is a way. The question is, though, do we have the will? Are we humans willing to disappoint our eyes a little by not buying into the latest fashions year after year and instead wearing clothing that lasts year after year? Would our eyes shed tears if we primarily wore clothes that were, dare I say it, pre-owned? Why are these eyes of ours not shedding tears, knowing the injurious and potentially fatal impact on the environment of our want to look fashionable, trendy, beautiful? We can say fashion is how we express ourselves. It's a form of art. I get it. But is the status quo expression and art something we can afford? Our evil eye of fashion is glaring at Mother Nature. Enough talk about wanting to keep our eyes happy when we look in the mirror. Let's move on to the matter of trying to satisfy our eyes' want for beauty when we look at the things we surround ourselves with, like our home, first of all. What are particularly bothersome to me are the very popular with many people, the home renovation shows. To the popularity point, in Canada alone in 2021, according to Statista.com, home improvement industry sales reached approximately $58.5 billion Canadian dollars. In the States, it's around $340 billion US dollars. To me, the shows reek of the concept of materialistic indulgence for the sake of aesthetic appeal, for having happy eyes. Yes, yes, I'm aware of the argument that renovating is more environmentally friendly than building from new, and I'm aware of the concept of investing in one's property in order to maximize retail value. And here again, as with the fashion industry, I understand the home is an extension of the self. It can be a form of personal artistic expression. That's how I feel about my home. However, are these indulgences coming at an environmental price that will bankrupt our lives? As with the fashion industry, I'm envisioning a paradigm shift where functionality trumps aesthetics, where pleasing the eye is not prioritized over environmental destruction. MadeInCanada.ca shares the apparently happy statistic that 80% of Canadians say sustainability is an important factor when making home improvements. But what does that mean? Are Canadians asking themselves, do I need that new bathroom because my current one just doesn't work anymore? Or do I want a nicer looking bathroom? Same for the kitchen. And if it's want versus need, are they saying, oh, I'll pass on the reno work or I'll use only repurposed materials? VisualCapitalist.com says, on average, renovations can generate approximately 60 pounds of waste per square foot. I haven't found stats on natural resources used in home rentals done for aesthetic purposes. And don't get me started on the sizes of new houses springing up as the last crop that will ever be produced on what was prime agricultural land. DarrenQualman.com notes that new homes in Canada and the U.S. are big and getting bigger. The average size of a newly constructed single-family detached home is now 2,600 square feet in the U.S. and probably 2,200 in Canada. The average size of a new house in the U.S. has doubled since 1960. End of quote. But the size of the average family in the U.S. over the same time period has decreased from 4 to 3 people. So it's not family size that's pushing up the square footage of single-family homes. Might it rather be the thought that the larger the home, the more attractive it's considered to be? Certainly, it's linked to social status most of the time, and status and attractiveness are frequently correlated. Personally, I'm much more impressed with a new home that is built with an eye for sustainability rather than an evil eye for aesthetics. That's where my mind's eye finds the beauty. And what about our personal property surrounding our home? Is it demonstrative of ecocentricity or egocentricity? An ecocentric property owner surveys their property with an earth-friendly eye on hospitableness to native plant diversity and insects. The egocentric with an eye on landscaped beauty to further enhance the beauty of their home. In 1830, the first mechanical lawnmower was made, enabling common folk to have manicured lawns like the wealthy landowners who hitherto had servants tend their lawns with hand scythes. Upkeep of grass lawns, such as have evolved since 1830, diminishes biodiversity and comes with heavy carbon costs. Lawnmowers, irrigation systems, and fertilizers add to households' carbon footprint. It comes as a shock to me to learn from my research that running a gas-powered lawnmower for 1 hour produces 11 times more emissions than running the average new car for the same duration. Wow! That makes me even happier to see that moss is taking over what used to be grassed areas of my property. No cutting needed there. But let's carry on with my ranting. What, I ask, is yet another thing outside our homes that could be contributing to the evil eye we humans are casting on Mother Nature because of our eye's greed for pretty things? How about that automobile in the driveway? I'm not talking about CO2 emissions. I'm talking about the evolution from prioritizing functionality to prioritizing aesthetics and the rise of the disposable car. I'm not sure there's a better demonstration of this than automobile advertising over the decades. Excerpts from the Nationwide Vehicle Contracts blog post called How Car Commercials Have Changed Over the Years describe the evolution. In the early days of television, the article begins, car commercials were relatively simple affairs. These ads tended to focus on the basic features of the car, such as its horsepower and fuel efficiency, and often featured a straightforward voiceover explaining these features. These ads were often shot in a studio setting with a plain black backdrop and the car itself as the main visual element. As television became more sophisticated in the 1970s and 80s, so too did car advertising. Ads from this period began to place more emphasis on the style and luxury of the car rather than just its basic features. These ads often featured exotic locations and glamorous models, with the car itself taking on a more prominent role as a status symbol. In the 1990s and 2000s, car advertising began to shift away from pure glamour and luxury and toward a more humorous and emotional approach. In recent years, car advertising has become increasingly high budget and sophisticated. Ads from this period often feature cutting-edge special effects, stunning cinematography, and big-name celebrities. There has also been a greater emphasis on environmental awareness and sustainability, with many ads highlighting the car's eco-friendly features. So all of that to say that the advertising has evolved from highlighting the main features of the vehicle to using eye-catching special effects to focus on the sexiness or visual appeal of the vehicle. If there is greater emphasis on environmental awareness, are there ads anywhere out there saying, feast your eyes on this practical, easily repairable vehicle that will serve you well for 20 or more years? As with so many manufactured products, especially in the electronics industry, the technology is there to replace built-in obsolescence with long life endurance. But apparently our evil eye wants to see a shiny, new, trendy, status-affirming vehicle in the driveway as opposed to a built-to-last model. Yet again, it may be argued, my vehicle is an expression of who I am. And the curse on Mother Nature of this visual indulgence, of this self-expression? Most of an automobile's environmental impact, perhaps 80 to 90%, says a NationalGeographic.com article, The Environmental Impacts of Cars, and it explains, will be due to fuel consumption and emissions of air pollution and greenhouse gases. However, notes the article, cars consume a lot of energy before they ever make it to the open road. Automotive production leaves a giant footprint because materials like steel, rubber, glass, plastics, paints, and many more must be created before a new ride is ready to roll. Similarly, the end of a car's life doesn't mark the end of its environmental impact. Plastics, toxic battery acids, and other products may stay in the environment. The article includes a positive note saying, junkyard pileups are becoming much smaller than they were in the past. About 3/4 of today's average car, including the bulk of a steel frame, can be recycled. End of quote. But this recycling cannot undo the enormous environmental damage of manufacturing and operating our vehicles. What could significantly reduce the damage is our willingness to stop indulging our eyes and ego. And that applies to other visual indulgences as well. Here's one more that you might not have even thought of: social media. According to Social Media Today, images help to grow more traffic, clicks, and conversion. Photos, videos, or infographics grab your user attention much faster and more effectively than text. But here again, our eyes' desire for nice, novel, new things to look at is costing us big time. Those photos, videos, or infographics might be great at grabbing attention, but sending these visuals requires data centers and vast servers needed to support the internet and store the content we access over it. Says BBC.com, although the energy needed for a single internet search or email is small, approximately 4.1 billion people, or 53.6% of the global population, now use the internet. Those scraps of energy and the associated greenhouse gases emitted with each online activity can add up. The carbon footprint of our gadgets, the internet, and the systems supporting them account for about 3.7% of global greenhouse emissions, according to some estimates. It is similar to the amount produced by the airline industry globally, explains Mike Hazaz, a researcher at Lancaster University. And these emissions are predicted to double by 2025, end of quote. Yikes. Are there any visuals our eyes can harmlessly indulge in? I would say we could walk outside and enjoy Mother Nature's beauty in real life. Sunsets, mountains, bodies of water, trees, animals, birds, insects. But this example could take me down yet another rabbit hole. More and more people are traveling to global-wide destinations to see the world. In 1950, says theworldcounts.com, there were 25 million international tourists arriving at their destinations. By 2030, 1.8 billion tourist arrivals are projected. The negative environmental impacts of tourism are substantial. They include the depletion of local natural resources as well as pollution and waste problems. Tourism often puts pressure on natural resources through overconsumption, often in places where resources are already scarce. Tourism puts enormous stress on local land use and can lead to soil erosion, increased pollution, natural habitat loss, and more pressure on endangered species. These effects can gradually destroy the environmental resources on which tourism itself depends. End of quote. Oh boy. Should we all poke our eyes out? Probably then we'd somehow instead destroy the world to indulge our sense of smell or taste or touch. But enough with the rant, enough of the sarcasm, Annie Gig. Thank you, listeners, for your ear, not your eye. But I cannot leave you with ears clogged with gloom and doom. I can't end this episode of Better Me, Better World without offering some hope of dispelling humanity's evil eye curse on Mother Nature. The hope I'm talking about doesn't lie in new technology, for example, direct air capture technologies to remove carbon from the atmosphere, or in culling plastics from the ocean, or in renewable energy. Although all these efforts are very important and helpful, and I believe we have to persist with such endeavors, I don't think they're enough and never will be. I also don't think we can ever stop money from making our capitalist world go round. I believe our hope lies in we, the people of the developed, industrialized, wealthy nations of the world, consuming much less, or at least consuming a different kind of material stuff, i.e. sustainably sourced, produced, and discarded stuff. This hope relies on change that is monumental in nature and must be globally inclusive. The hope cannot be generated by the elite or corporations throwing endless money at the problems, by brilliant innovators, by governments, by religious organizations, by environmental groups. The hope requires a reset of each individual human being, because it is individuals who collectively make up our species, and only a species-wide effort will have a fighting chance at saving humanity and many, many other earthly species. And what is this reset? It's a change of mindset. It's each of us knowing cognitively and emotionally that we do not need to possess material things or stuff to be happy, to live the good life, to flourish, to have self-esteem and self-worth, to love and be loved. It's about not needing to be conspicuous consumers, to show up as superior to others by virtue of showing off our more and better stuff. The bigger home, newer cars, vacations, toys, designer clothes, meals out, stocks, money. It's about being empowered through self-awareness and self-development, not quasi empowered by the poor substitute called wealth. Consumerism thrives on emotional voids, said Carolyn Knapp, an American writer and columnist who wrote about her attempts at her personal reset. If we fill these emotional voids healthfully by investing in holistic personal wellness at the individual and societal levels, such that individuals no longer feel the need to possess material things to be complete or enough, how liberating might it be, mentally and emotionally, to feel happy and fulfilled without endlessly needing more and better stuff? What might non-materialism do for the future of our species and our home? I can say what a move towards less materialism, towards needing less eye candy, has done for me personally. My move in this direction correlates to my BU journey of becoming more aware, more accepting, and self-loving. For years, I measured myself, my worth, against others, and always came up inferior. My house, my gardens, my cars, my clothes, my vacations, my entertainment activities were, to my mind, always less than those of my friends and siblings, never good enough. I was not scoring too well according to the measures I was using for life success. However, as I've been developing intrinsic, i.e. mental, emotional, spiritual enoughness through self-discovery and self-development work, those extrinsic props, I've noticed, are becoming increasingly irrelevant. I've come to appreciate that life's success is actually measured by abiding peace of mind, which is definitely enhanced by letting go of the need for more, shinier, newer, bigger, better material things. I'm not all the way there yet. I haven't reduced my carbon footprint as much as I can. I post my Silhouette Kids images on social media. I could view my endeavors at changing my lifestyle in environmentally supportive ways relative to endeavors of my friends and family, but I'd be falling back into that unhealthy comparison mentality again, wouldn't I? The only thing that's important is the size of my current personal carbon footprint relative to yesterday's. As in all other aspects of my life, I remain a work in progress. I can't help but think if billions of materially privileged consumers around the globe lived according to the mentality of better me, better world, we might have a better chance of breaking humanity's evil eye curse on Mother Nature. And why is this so important, other than perhaps avoiding the destruction of our planet by ravaging its resources? David Attenborough says it nicely, referring to other ways Mother Nature is a source for us humans without being damaged by us. He says, "It seems to me that the natural world is the greatest source of excitement, the greatest source of visual beauty, the greatest source of intellectual interest. It is the greatest source of so much in life that makes life worth living." And that's a wrap. I invite you to tune in to the next episode of Better Me, Better World for my thoughts on the advisability of society prioritizing self-awareness and self-development work for both our sake individually and the sake of planet Earth. I'll be back same time next week, same place here at CFRU 93.3 FM or CFRU.ca. The shows are recorded, so alternatively, have a listen when it works best for you. Until next time, be you. I'm Annie Gigg.